the first lesson said, Doug, you misspelled it in the last lesson. It was, let's reconsider mediation. Since about March, I've kind of been feeling this interior weight about my own life and about our community. When I get that kind of weighted feeling, I kind of interpret it as a nudge from the inner voice. And that inner nudge got stronger when I spoke to Jennifer. And as you know, Jennifer is kind of in charge of the contemplative quadrant of our working the circle. And she'd been feeling a similar kind of weightiness or inner nudge. And that is that it would be good for us as a community, it would be good for me as a human being to give more shared focus together to helping one another be more steadfast in the practices of the contemplative, more steadfast in our practice of meditation. And so I realize that I need to be helping others be steady so that I can be in the environment where others are helping me be steady. We need that kind of symbiotic relationship that comes when we do things better together than we do alone. So I know that's true of me. I suspect that's true for others. Well, our community has been focused on some really important things, becoming agents of healing in our community, grappling with our nation's inherited sin of racism, learning tools to help us love our neighbors, even when the force-feed story machine is telling us that our neighbor is our enemy. And these things that we've been focused on have been really important, consuming us kind of important. But as you hear me say all the time, every time we say yes, we're in some way saying no to something else. And we didn't really say no to focusing on contemplative practice, but that has not been our focus for some time as we have navigated these times lately. And so here comes this interior weight, this sense of nudge. It's time. It's time. Contemplative practice helps us bring our best selves, helps us bring our best selves to volatile times. And you may be aware, we're living in volatile times right now, and we desperately need to be our best selves. So this fall, we'll focus on both, restitching the torn fabric of community and helping one another be faithful to contemplative practice. So you already heard the announcement about the module that's going on now. It would be a good thing to participate in. So today's lesson is kind of background for that. This fall, Jennifer and I are thinking about practicalities, how we can practically help one another be steady. One of the practical things we already decided is that when we're deciding what to do about music once George leaves, that will leave some weeks in August and September for us to do more contemplative Sundays than we typically do. Because often, when we're in the time of discerning, the contemplative is one of the ways that we do that. So we'll be doing that through August and September. But today is some background. Actually, it's some theological background. And I hate to use that word, but let me talk about what theology is when it's at its best. When theology is at its best, it is grappling with the big human questions. And here's one of those questions. What are we? We human beings, what are we? We are bodies, yes. We are minds, yes. We are conscious thoughts. We are unconscious motivations, yes, yes. We are good, yes. We are bad, often. The human condition really is a swirling mix of contradictions. And it turns out, what part of the swirl that you focus on, what part of the swirl of contradictions that informs the story that you tell yourself about yourself, where your focus goes tends to have a very powerful impact on the kind of life that we live, that you live while you're on this planet. So, this is one of the big questions that we human beings have puzzled over since we came to conscious awareness. What are we? And part of the thing that triggered that struggle is the question of how it is, why it is, that we are such lofty beings, virtuous, noble, high-minded, decent. One of our texts calls us just a little bit lower than the angels. And at the same time, that we are so consistently dishonorable and small-minded and unscrupulous and wicked, good and bad, light and dark, saints and sinners. What is it, this human sense of being? One of the ancient texts compares us to a well that gives water that is both sweet and bitter. How can that be that one well gives two? How can it be that we are so consistently noble and virtuous, unscrupulous and wicked? How does that work? What's the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves? Now, if we were grappling with this question as scientists, we would talk about evolutionary theory. We would talk about how mutations favor the offspring, because we want advantageous mutations in order to help the offspring survive and thrive. Consequently, we would see that all of us, we carry genes of competition because that favors the offspring, that favors the making of offspring. Sometimes that competition is brutal, red in tooth and claw. But competitive genes aren't the only ones that favor offspring. Through these millennia that we have been on this earth, our tribes and our bands did better collectively if they cooperated, if they cared for one another, if they were compassionate toward one another. Because it turns out, if I care for another person today, there's a very good chance that when I am in need tomorrow, someone will care for me. And so, as we look at this process that has brought us to this beautiful process that has brought us into being, we find that our brains carry selfless and caring and cooperating instincts, and we find that our brains carry selfish and uncaring and competitive instincts. In these last few generations, scientists like Steven Pinker and historians like Robert Wright point to a historical trend that the size of our cooperative groups has a directionality to it. In other words, the size of those groups are not getting smaller and smaller. The size of those groups through history are getting bigger and bigger, larger and larger versions of us. Now, that is a trend from a historical perspective, notwithstanding how fractious it feels to be an American today. These things tend to go through history like a stock chart. They go up and they go down, but over time they inevitably move up. There is an expansion of the versions of us. That would be how we would talk about it if we were thinking from a scientific perspective. So when religious people puzzle over this same problem, the language is different, but the conclusions are very similar. Religious people would use the language of the triumph of God, or the eschatological promise of God. That is not a word you need to know. That is a theology nerd word. Well, we would talk about how God is reconciling all things to God. That's what Paul told us. How in the end, good will win. Bad will eventually be vanquished, and good will eventually triumph. That's how we tell the story in religious language sometimes. But other times, we tell it completely the other way. Sometimes we use our religious language to tell the story that the bad is winning, that only a few of us will experience the triumph of good, and everybody else will be destroyed by the bad. Sorry, this slide made it in, and then I deleted the stuff that I was going to say, so forget that slide. Here's the theology part. Two stories are usually told us in our religious tradition about who we are. The first story is that we are intrinsically good, and bad is an overlay on top of the good. And the other story, you can imagine, is that we are intrinsically bad, and good is the overlay on top of that. So, when we tell the we are bad story, we use terms like we are originally sinful, or we are genetically sinful, or we are hopelessly sinful, or totally depraved. Those are some words that are thrown around when we are telling the we are essentially bad story. If there is goodness in us, this story goes, it is at best an afterthought, but it is surely not enough to take us to the fruition of our human destiny. Now, that version of the story, the we are intrinsically bad story, got a big boost when Rome took over Western Christianity in 327 AD. At that time, we took a Hebrew story that said that we were breathed by God's very essence, and we twisted and turned it, and it became the you are bad story. What our texts tell us in John 1:9 were de-elevated, and instead were elevated other texts that talk about all of us being so hopelessly bad. Sinful was the word. Well, it turns out the you are bad and good is an overlay story worked really well for Rome's kind of intrinsic, unspoken, unarticulated, but deeply embedded within them narrative, because they were about the business of conquering. They were about the business of taking over the known world. They were about the business of going to people and going to lands and taking it. And that's kind of hard to do if the people there are intrinsically made of the spirit of the divine. But it's much easier to do if the people there are ugly, ugly, sinful, depraved. Because then we can go there, take their land, and lo and behold, we're going to offer them the true religion anyway. We're giving them hope. We're giving them a chance. We can keep that narrative and be imperialistic conquerors. And so this version of the story took a big boost or gained a big boost at that time. Now, if you grew up in the West, if you grew up in America, and if you went to church, most of us were influenced by the Roman-influenced narrative of Western Christianity. The convergence of religion and imperial power, the church being a shill for the empire, we never told that part of the story. But you did pick up pretty quickly, pretty early on, that we are bad. We are sinful. We are really, really, really bad. And in fact, sin is not just a deal. Sin is not just a big deal. Sin is the deal. It's the main point. It's the thing that we have to grapple with. Now, you might want to get your cameras out, because in a moment I'm going to show you a slide, not this slide, but the next slide. You might want to snap a photo of it so you can read up on this stuff later. But there is a chance that you could have grown up in a Christian church that was not shaped by the Roman Christian Alliance. There was a chance that you could have grown up in a church that did not trade the divine center, the breath of God that is part of our story, for the ugly, ugly, sin-depraved center. There is a chance that you could have grown up in a church that kept the image of God, the breath of God, as the center, the deepest part of our human nature. Then your story would be, whatever sin is, and by the way, for both of the stories, sin is a serious thing, but whatever it is not the defining center of our humanity. So here's where you might want to take a photo, just because that's a lot of words. When I read up on these terms, it was a moment of enlightenment for me. I came to understand something that completely transformed my life. I discovered that there are cousins of ours in our Christian tradition, and these cousins do not tell the story the way that we do. Several streams of our tradition were not infected by the political alliance with Rome. These wings of the Christian church tell a very different story about sin and about our humanity. It would be time well spent to read about the Quakers and Inner Light, Google that term, Eastern Orthodox Church and Divine Light, Celtic Christianity and Light of the Sun, Coptic Christianity and One Nature, the Desert Fathers and Mothers, and Human Nature. You could read about those, and it would be an afternoon well spent. Or you could read the book, and I read all those people, and I can tell you what they said. So, here at NRCC, we have opted to tell the second story, the we are every one of us carriers of the indwelling divine story. We are, every one of us, animated by the breath of God story. And in our story, the foundational beginnings never went away. We never did anything, apple eating or some other iteration thereof, we never did anything that drove the divine center out of the very core of our being. So that means that for us, sin is a deal, but it is not the biggest deal. Well, when we say that, you hear us say it all the time, sin is not that big a deal. We're mounting a challenge to Rome. We are not mounting a challenge to Jesus. We are mounting a challenge in particular to Augustine, who was a 5th century theologian who articulated this Roman narrative. And we are saying, no, Augustine, we argue with you. We don't argue with the Judeo-Christian tradition that is found in so much of our scripture. We are saying that the deepest part of who we are still carries the divine, still carries the Spirit of God. So that still leaves us, however, with this big issue of sin. That's a deal, not the biggest deal, but it's a deal. And it's a it'll destroy you kind of deal. It's a it'll destroy everything you love kind of deal. So it's a deal, and we ought to deal with it. It's just not the defining who you are deal. And the reason that matters is because what we do next is kind of determined by the kind of story we tell ourselves about human nature and sin. Well, in this story, the you are a carrier of the divine light story, the John 1:9 story, when this is our story, we begin by saying sin is something, but it's not the defining center. The something is stories. Stories that we pick up along the way, no matter who we are, no matter where we grew up, they are wired into our brain to pick up these stories. And to some degree or another, when we do, we end up believing something to be true that is not true. Now, these are usually primal stories, and they go with the limbic part of our brains. We are naturally magnets for these stories, and we bring them in at a very tender age, at a very young age, and they are stories like, I am not good, or I am not good enough, or I am safe, but I'm not safe enough, or I am not strong, or I'm not strong enough, or I'm not loved, or I'm not loved enough. These are primal stories. They're deeply visceral, embedded stories. They go to the core of what it means to live in the mind. And these stories are at the core of their at the core of the story itself. They're intolerable for us to bear. We cannot live in a world in which I am not loved, or in which I am not strong, or in which I am not safe, or so. We've got these primal stories that are inadequate, and yet we've been a magnet for them, and we've brought them into the core of who we are. And so, because we cannot live with them, we have to mitigate them somehow. We have to massage them somehow. We have to work with them somehow, because if we don't, they will demotivate us, they will debilitate us, they will suck us dry. We will not be able to get up and do what needs to be done to make this human existence work with these stories not somehow handled. And so we handle them. And the way that we handle them is that we develop strategies that will help us mitigate them. So we massage them so that life will be tolerable, and so we can feel safe, or at least not in so much danger, so that we can feel powerful, or at least not so weak, or we can feel lovable. We please other people so that they tell us that we are love worthy, or we do some kind of a strategy to make that story, down deep at the core of who we are, make it not so influential, not so powerful in our lives. And eventually, the story and the compensating strategies that we build on top of that story become so ingrained in us that we can't tell the difference between story and strategy and self. Pretty soon, those stories become so ingrained that they equal me. This is who I am. This is what I do. It's what I always do. This is how I think, because this is what is true, and this is what is real, and this is just the facts. And we find ourselves creating a whole system. Oh, yeah, I was behind a slide. Consider this as the last slide. This is the slide. we find ourselves doing a whole bunch of actions and a whole bunch of reactions, thinking a whole bunch of thoughts, having a bunch of emotional responses. This whole construct that is our interior world is somehow predicated upon this story that we have bought early on at that very visceral level. It is who I am. And those strategies become the ingrained version that we have of self. And it turns out that those strategies are getting really close to the word that we use, the meaning that we assign to the word sin. Because even though my strategy might be a kindness strategy, I'm going to be so kind to you, you are going to like me, and then I'm going to feel loved. Even though it might be a goodness strategy, I'm going to do everything God asks me to do. I'm going to serve everything God asks me to serve. I'm going to do all that stuff, then God will love me, then I'm going to be okay. Even though it might be a goodness strategy, it is nevertheless, at the core of what it is, handcrafted to do something for me, to help me deal with a truth that is not true. There's a reason why we quote that kind of obscure saying of Jesus all the time. It's because it's directly related to this. Jesus said, when the light inside of you is darkness, whoa, how great is the darkness. If the truth that you believe to be true isn't true, you're going to be running along on the basis of this truth, and you'll be zigging every time you needed to zag. You'll be doing what you think is right and true. You'll actually put a virtuous name on it. You will call it something wonderful that you are doing, but it will be destroying you. And that is worthy of the word sin. Because what happens is, eventually, no matter how noble or how devoted or how pious our strategy is, it's going to eventually run afoul of its own inadequacy. What's going to happen is we will run into a person who we will run into a set of circumstances. We will be in competition with someone else's strategy, someone else's habituated practice or belief, that we will come up and say, okay, here's my strategy. I'm going to be liked. And I'm going to learn how to be liked. I'm going to do all the things that need. And you will eventually run into someone who, try as you might, will not like you. Now, how do you deal with that? Or your strategy might be, okay, I am going to be powerful, and I'm going to control all the variables. That's what I'm going to do. And you will eventually run into a circumstance you cannot control. You will eventually run into a place where you have to acknowledge your weakness. And if my whole strategy for living in the world is to not be weak, and now I can't but be weak, you're going to start having a problem. And when you have a problem, you're probably going to start behaving badly. And you're probably going to say words that probably not the best words. You're probably going to think thoughts. You're probably going to have actions. You're probably going to have reactions. You're going to define your relationships on the basis of this thing that's not working for me. And that's what we call sin. All those actions and those words and those thoughts, we call that sin. And if that's the sin that we have, we've kind of missed the point. That's the symptom. The cause is the truth that I believe that is not true. When the light inside of me is darkness, how great is that darkness? Because it turns out that the actions are the byproduct. They're not the engine that's driving the process. And so when that happens, storms ensue. Energy is evoked. Bad thoughts are thought. Bad words are said. Bad things are done. Well, of course, that happens because we're creating a strategy predicated on a truth that isn't true. That's what happens when your truth isn't true. When your truth isn't true, no matter how much you believe it, if you act on it, it isn't, in the long run, going to work. And then when it doesn't work, our equilibrium system takes a hit, and we need a squirt of dopamine in our brains to feel good. Because this thing isn't working, I am despairing, and people who despair can't get up and do what needs to be done, so I need something to get a little squirt of dopamine in my head, and so I'll go out, and I will maybe drink too much, or maybe I will drug too much, or I'll have sex in an inappropriate way, or I will lie, or I will cheat, or I will steal, or I will eat too many comfort foods, or I will do something to get that squirt of dopamine, and then we call that stuff sin. But it wasn't the point. The point was the narrative that wasn't working, the truth that wasn't true. So we end up trivializing this word sin, and we end up calling it a nature or saying it's the defining center of who we are, or we call it the bad actions that we do, and we miss the point that when the truth inside of you isn't true, it will destroy you and everyone you love. The problem is that we have trivialized the word sin. We've made it the problem when it's not the problem. It's the result of the problem. So consequently, it's hardly ever a good strategy to deal with sin by trying to just don't do it. It works for a little while. Usually, research shows, about 6 weeks. You can go about 6 weeks white-knuckling it. You can go for about that much time. It's like if you take something light. This is very light. Everyone could hold this. But you hold that thing for 5 minutes, and then you hold it for 7 minutes, then you hold it for 9 minutes, and pretty soon you're realizing, oh, my Lord, I can't hold this thing any longer. Pretty soon, at 20 minutes, you start thinking, this is going to kill me. But it's light. It's nothing. That's what happens when our truth isn't true. We try and cap this stuff off, and we try and not do this stuff. And in the process, we end up inevitably weakening over time. It's just, there's a great book you might enjoy. It's called The Willpower Instinct. It's all about the brain science of self-control. It's a great understanding of, oh, it's a science book, but I read it as a religious man, and I thought, this is just talking about this whole debate, this religious struggle with human nature. Anyway, that's a freebie. So it's never a good idea just to try and cap this thing off. It's never a good idea just to swear before God, I will never do this thing again, to just rein this thing in, to just control this thing, because if we don't deal with the driver beneath the actions, we don't ever pull away the power. Every ounce of energy that we spend trying to cap off our words and to cap off our deeds is an ounce of energy we don't spend dealing with the driver, the untruthful truth. But if we will defang the story, if we will disempower the story, if we will unseat these powerful but faulty narratives, then, as the picture shows, the center within, the breath of God that animated our very being, the Spirit of God that was breathed into us, our first story tells us, that thing that we carry inside of ourselves, it will radiate out. It will come out of us because it is not blocked by the competition with the faulty narratives. Radiating the divine is as normal to the human being as growing fingernails. In some way, the fingernails are there inside of us, just waiting to come out. Give them a little time and they will come out. In the same way, the divine is within us, just waiting to come out. But the competition with these faulty narratives and these compensating strategies and these actions and reactions, and then the doubling down on those things, and then the reacting to them not working, and then the compensating by then developing some byproduct strategy, all that stuff gets in there and the divine doesn't radiate out. Once our faulty, illusory stories are unseated, once the hold that they have upon us is weakened, once they are disempowered or shown to be the illusory narratives that they are, once we do what Paul enjoined us to do, have this mind in you, the mind that was in Christ Jesus, or once we do what Paul said, have your mind renewed by the Spirit of God, once that happens, the divine is there, just waiting to radiate out. It has always been there. That's why we say when we talk about contemplative spirituality, the journey to God is not a journey out there. The journey to God is a quieting, stilling process to the indwelling Spirit of God. It's a journey in here. Well, it turns out that if that's your narrative, there are several ways to begin working to weaken, to disempower these stories. One of the most helpful ones is meditation. One of the most helpful ways to weaken those stories, even when we can't name them, is contemplative spirituality. To disentangle ourselves from these powerful stories, faulty stories, is to meditate, is to practice examine of consciousness, is to practice Lectio Divina. And so again, I've been feeling a weightiness in my own life, and a weightiness on behalf of our community that we give focus and attention to helping one another be faithful to our contemplative practice. That's why you'll be hearing this summer both Restitching the Torn Fabric of Community and Helping One Another Be Faithful to Our Contemplative Practice. So here's the thing. It is difficult to sit quietly because we do what we have done. And what we have done is to create a habituated state in our bodies of clenching. When we don't process our interior experiences, our interior stressors, we carry them somewhere. We carry them in our shoulders. We carry them in our necks. We carry them in our faces. We carry them around our mouth. We carry them in our stomach. We carry them in our lower back. We carry this in the form of clenching. And so the habituated state is clenching, clenching, clenching. It is difficult to go up against habit. It's difficult to sit quietly because the habituated state of our minds is busy, busy, busy. Thinking, thinking, thinking. Swing from one thought to the next thought to the next thought to the next thought and do that all day. And if I did that all day yesterday, it's much more likely I'm going to do that all day today. And I've done that now for 40 years, then I'm going to keep doing that and keep doing that and keep doing that because that becomes the habituated state. And so our tradition has given us this very simple practice. It's simple. It does come with a whole lot of tools that help us because breaking habit is very, very difficult. But the simple practice is to return our bodies to relaxation when they clench. And then we relax. And you give this thing about 6 seconds. Sure enough, it'll come back. And then you relax again. Give this thing another 6 seconds, and it'll happen again. And the face will do this, and you'll be relaxing and relaxing. But while you're doing, your mouth will be pursing. It is crazy when you start to pay attention how habit controls and dominates us. And by simply returning our minds to our breathing or to our sacred word, this was in the first service we practiced that, our minds are habituated to run with commentary, to keep going and keep going with thought thinking, thought thinking, thought thinking. And these simple practices trained us to disentangle from our compulsive nature that's driven by habit. The simple practice trains us to disentangle ourselves from the power, the compulsive power of our thoughts and our emotions, the narratives that drive our days. This simple practice trains us to disidentify with the story. That is a story I tell myself. And it is a story I've been telling myself for a long time. And almost always when I have a kind of afflictive emotion, I can tell one of those stories is in the mix. Yes, that is a story I tell, but that is not me. And that is a powerful distinction between, boy, that's a habitual story I tell, and this is me, and this is truth, and this is real. What the practice of contemplation does is begin to disentangle us from the this is me way of relating to those stories. Meditate regularly for a few months, and we find ourselves beginning to have choices that we did not have. This person that has always triggered me, I now have a choice. I can be with them and be not triggered. I couldn't do that before. This circumstance that always throws me into a tailspin, I now have a choice. I can be in this circumstance. This circumstance can descend upon me, and I can be not augering in. I can be not triggered. I have a choice now that I didn't have. An insight that has always blown past me in my busy, busy days with my busy, busy mind, I can actually now have a choice. And my choice is to heed it and to hear it. I did not have that choice a while ago. When I talk about this, I use the illustration of WRL all the time because I watch their weather guy. WRL is just swimming through this room all the time. It's here. But we don't see WRL because we haven't created the receiver that will receive and give it to us. That's what our minds do when they're busy, busy, busy. All the wisdom that you need, it's always right here. All the insight you need, all the strength you need, all the courage you need, all the fruit of the Spirit of God, it's all right here. But we're not accessible because we don't have an open heart and an open hand. And what happens is we have an option to wisdom that we didn't have. I raised a child. he's my son. This is the one I raised. Who is not like me. And I had a story that I was living on that defined what a good person was, that defined what a good human being did, and what a good parent did to raise a good child. And I was closed off to a tremendous amount of wisdom that was always just floating around. It was always there, and I was closed off to it because I had a story that could not accept that. And I noticed when I had been meditating, like daily, I've been meditating for years, but when I started doing it daily, I started seeing what I hadn't seen about how to raise this child, about how to talk to this child, about what matters to this child, about how to reach this child. And I began to have access, options, choices that I didn't have before because my narrative had closed me off to the wisdom of God that is always present. Meditation weakens the false stories that dominate us. Meditation weakens the false stories that drive us. It frees us from the compulsive nature of our choices. I have to do this because it's the only thing to do. This is what I've always done. This is the way life goes. We are freed from the compulsive power, and we begin to have choices. We begin to be free. And here's the thing. We want to be free. We don't always want to sit down and meditate, but we want to be free. We want access to the wisdom and to the insight that is missed so easily by our busy, busy minds, our narrative-driven minds. We want the freedom to connect with and care for those we would previously have avoided because they poked our strategy. We want to be free. We don't always want to meditate, but we want to be free. So I'm thinking about helping others who will in turn be helping me to be faithful to my practice. Jennifer is looking for spaces for us to create together where we can help one another be faithful to our practice because I want to be free and I want us to be free. If we're going to take up our role as healers of the earth, we can't really afford not to do this thing. But if we help one another, and if you start, it's a good place to start, is with your own network of spiritual friends. If we help one another and you talk together about how you can help one another be faithful to your practice, we could do this hard thing. We could be faithful, steadfast in our contemplative practice. So I pray it would be so, Lord, in our lives and in our community as we follow Jesus. Amen.